Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today on Basic, John Slattery from Mad Men. If I'm not mistaken, you read for the role of Don Draper before you read for Roger, right?
I did, only because there wasn't much of Roger in the pilot script. I had to call my agent back and say, really, are you sure? Because I looked older than the part and I wasn't getting parts that age at that point. So I did my homework and I went in and read and did a couple of passes at it. And that's when he told me, well, here's the thing, we already have this guy. And then he claims that I was in a bad mood the whole time when we shot the pilot because he had lied to me, which I don't think that was true. I think we shot the pilot in New York and I think I was just maybe skeptical. You hedge your bets a little bit emotionally anyway, you kind of protect yourself. Well, you know, we'll see. And again, the part wasn't that much in evidence in the pilot. So I kind of felt like I had 1 foot in and 1 foot out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Basic, the official podcast of the unofficial history of cable television. I'm Doug Herzog, a former TV executive, and I'm just back from a three-martini lunch.
And I'm Jen Chaney, TV critic at Vulture and New York Magazine, and I drink because it's what men do.
I'm pretty excited today, Jen. Our guest today was a star of one of Basic Cable's most celebrated shows, and I think a personal favorite of both you and myself.
Yes, we are talking about Mad Men, and we are welcoming John Slattery, who played Roger Sterling, a senior partner at the various iterations of the fictional ad agency on Mad Men. He's played many roles on TV and film, but Roger Sterling is the one that he's best known for. Roger was a quick-witted ladies' man and a heavy drinker who also got to deliver some of the sharpest lines in Mad Men history.
The show was the first Basic Cable show to win an Emmy for Best Drama, something that had been the domain of primarily network shows or HBO shows. Over seven seasons, it went on to win 16 Emmys and 5 Golden Globes.
And perhaps more surprisingly, it came from the AMC network, who at that time was considered kind of a B-level cable network that was most known for airing old movies. But Mad Men captured a very specific era in American history with extraordinary style and some of the best writing and performances ever on television.
I think that's right. I think it's also safe to say that its quality and success took everyone by surprise. We're going to get right to our conversation with John, but stay right after as Jen and I will be at the bar to recap our conversation over a couple of dirty martinis.
We are so excited to welcome John Slattery to the Basic Podcast. Doug and I are huge Mad Men fans, so this is very exciting. But before we start talking about Mad Men, we have to ask you the question we ask everyone who comes on the podcast, which is, do you remember when you first got or saw Basic Cable television?
You know, I've been thinking about that, and I think we got Basic Cable in like 85, where I was living, except at that point I had left home, finished college, was on the road with a touring group, and then moved to Brooklyn, where I don't think I had a TV. So I remember people talking about getting Basic Cable, and I remember my brother in MTV and him, you know, sort of becoming addicted to that. But no, the answer is I remember when I didn't get Basic Cable. Because I didn't have a television and no money and had just moved to New York. And I also remember not having, you know, trying to get through the scramble to see something untoward or adult. In our prior residence, we moved from Newton, Massachusetts to Wellesley. And before we moved to the mean streets of Wellesley, I remember trying to sift through the scramble to see if you could see anything going on.
Those were the good old days, yeah.
Did you have any luck?
Occasionally, you'd be like, you couldn't remember if you couldn't actually just, you know, did I imagine that? Did I actually see that? Anyway, that's a long-winded answer, which the short end of which is not really.
Yeah. But you did mention growing up in New England and you grew up right in the sort of greater Boston area.
That's right.
And wanted to be a ball player when you were a kid. Was that your first instinct?
Big sports family, played a lot of everything. My uncle was the traveling secretary for the Red Sox. So we kind of lived in Fenway Park, my whole bunch of cousins and I. Only the sort of kid aspirations. And the older I got, the less likely that was apparently going to become.
I was in the bleachers at the Bucky Dent game, and I am a Yankee fan. I just have to reveal that, John.
All right.
This is going to go terribly from here on in.
I was at that game, too.
Hopefully we can get through this.
And I was at the game prior to that where they got into that playoff game.
Were you there?
Anyway.
Were they tied it up? Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Before Mad Men, you were in a number of things. I think a lot of people remember you for your run on Sex and the City. I fondly remember you from Ed, which is a show that I feel like people don't talk about enough because it was such a great show.
It was a good show.
So you obviously had done a lot, but then Mad Men comes along. And if I'm not mistaken, you read for Don's for the role of Don Draper before you read for Roger, right?
I did. Only because there wasn't much of Roger in the pilot script. Mm-hmm. I was doing a play, the David Lindsay Abaire play called Rabbit Hole with Cynthia Nixon. And I think Matt had come to see that.
Okay.
And asked me to read for the part of Don. Yeah. And I had to call my agent back and say, really, are you sure? Because I looked older than the part and I wasn't getting parts that age at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I did call back to check and they said, no, that's what they said. So I did my homework and I went in and read and did a couple of passes at it. And that's when he told me, well, here's the thing. We already have this guy. And then he claims that I was in a bad mood the whole time when we shot the pilot because he had lied to me, which I don't think that was true. I think we shot the pilot in New York and I think I was just maybe skeptical. I remember giving somebody a ride home, an actor, Darren Petty, who was in the show for years. We were both like, well, AMC hadn't done much original programming. They had a little bit, but we just kind of, you know, you hedge your bets a little bit emotionally anyway. You kind of protect yourself. Well, you know, we'll see. And again, the part wasn't that much in evidence in the pilot. So
right.
I kind of felt like I had one foot in and one foot out.
Did Matthew tell you that he had plans for Roger to be a bigger character, or did you just not know at that point?
No, he told me, and I was a huge Sopranos fan, and I had known Matt a little bit socially because we had mutual friends from that show, from Sopranos. And he told me that, I promise you, this will be a great part. But, you know, I'd heard that before and you hear that all the time.
Sure.
Right.
The harder someone tries to sell you, usually the less likely it's going to be a good part. And it wasn't a super hard sell. He was just like, I promise you, this will be a great part. And you could see how good the script was. Mm-hmm. But I think he said the same thing to January Jones, which she played Betty in the last scene. You don't even know he's married until he comes home and
right.
She wakes up. So I guess she took it on faith as well. And it turned out pretty well for her as well.
And the AMC of it all, they really were, they weren't on the map at all in those days in terms of original program. You said they had tried their hand here and there, but you know, they were mostly known, I think, for running old movies, right?
They were. But they had a show, I forget the name of it. They had a show about,
it's something that clicked a little bit,
like a radio station, a period show.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
about the 40s
that.
Radio. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I remember that. But yeah, they were, you know, people would say A&E and, you know, or nobody knew how to find them or what it was all about. So I think everybody was skeptical, but there was no skepticism about how good that script was. And then how good the subsequent scripts were, which was to me even more surprising because it was clear that he was good on his word, Matt, that is, mm-hmm. and the parts were terrific. And we would go in to do these table reads.
Did it get a quick pickup, like between the pilot and getting started? Was there?
I don't think so. I think it took a minute, and then Matt had to finish his Sopranos obligation, it was like a year until we started shooting it again.
Wow.
It might have gotten picked up for a while, so that we had a while knowing the show was going to go.
Right.
But again, I'm fuzzy on it. It's been a while.
You know, I asked that because knowing cable television economics, you know, like I did, it's big bite, you know, to do a show like this for any cable network. And I'm sure they, you know, as good as that pilot was, I'm sure they really thought long and hard before they made the commitment because it was going to be a lot more money than they had ever spent before. I promise you that.
Yeah.
So a year is interesting.
As much as lavish as it looked, it was, I don't think the budgets were very big and that we were 7-day episode, which is amazing when you think, you know, how long it takes some, like HBO would shoot twice that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't blink. We were pretty tight. But anyway, the scripts got better and better. And I remember just commenting on like, this isn't usually the way this goes. Usually takes a really long time to write the pilot script, and it's fussed over and considered and paid a lot of attention to. And then the show gets a pickup, and then you're off and running, and you've got to crank out a show every 10 days and the quality can go down, you know, take a dip. But that's not what happened, obviously.
I mean, that's one of the great things, many great things about Mad Men to me, is that it felt like everything was considered. You know, nothing was in there by accident in terms of the writing or anything else. But I'm curious, so in season one, was there a point where you were like, okay, this Roger Sterling guy is a great character? Like, there was a moment when you really hooked into him?
It was right away. It was like, I think we were walking into Elizabeth Moss and I were walking into a table read. And I was like, is it me or are these scripts getting better each week? And she agreed, and we were, you know, it was clear right away that the whole world had been considered, that he'd been thinking about this for a long time. Mm-hmm. And which he, you know, he's subsequently said he had the whole thing mapped out. Mm-hmm. I mean, not where the whole thing went, but the you know, a vision of this world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, I've been just literally coincidentally rewatching with my wife, and just, it's amazing how it just whole, every part of it holds up, just every scene, every character, every costume, every set. And it just, yeah, it just all feels like it's been there forever. It felt also as a viewer that it took off really quickly in terms of its popularity and acceptance and critical acclaim. Is that how you remember it? And how did that, you know, how did that feel on the set, and how did that impact you guys?
I remember toiling away in obscurity for a little while. I think we were there. We were at LA Center Studios downtown. So we weren't at one of the big studios in Hollywood or in, you know, the Valley. It got uniformly good reviews. I remember there was a poster with all the quotes, and it was just basically a full-size poster with just newspapers all over the place and quotes from everywhere. But there was a period where we were just kind of working away and then came on the air. I'm sure John Hamm has a different recounting of it because his life changed pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I think everybody's did, and there was a lot of attention and publicity. And then, but I don't really remember. I think it took a little beat. And then also, I think, and I haven't, you know, talked about this in a long time, but I remember someone either bringing it up or acknowledging that being able to record shows came into being at this point in time. So you could go back and get the show, or you could TiVo the whole thing, or whatever, you DVR the whole thing.
That's right.
So that if it wasn't like if someone told you about a show and you're like, well, I guess I missed that boat, you couldn't, you know, you could go back and see the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. And that made a big difference.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/Pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
This was also when it started to become more apparent that whatever your overnight ratings were, which were always like sort of the gospel of figuring out whether a show was successful, we're not capturing how much impact a show was having.
Right.
Because Mad Men was having a huge cultural impact, even if, like you said, the overnight ratings might not show that, but people were watching it on their own time.
Yeah.
And I remember I worked at the Washington Post at the time, and I actually wrote about television, but literally everyone in the newsroom when Mad Men was popular wanted to write about Mad Men. Like, it was like everybody wanted to do recaps. I'm like, some of you need to be covering the White House. This is my department. Like, calm down. but it spoke to how much people loved the show. And I wanted to ask you about a few scenes, really memorable scenes, as sort of a window into the process, starting with one in season one when Roger and Don go out and Roger just eats a few too many oysters and has a few too many martinis and throws up on the members of Nixon's campaign. Mad Men would do these sort of like kind of, for lack of a better word, gross out moments every once in a while, like the lawnmower. Don throws up at your, is it your mom's memorial service, I think?
Yeah.
A memorial service.
My mom's funeral.
Yeah. Always a good place
to. What a prince.
Yeah. So what do you remember about shooting that sequence when you had to basically upchuck on these poor men?
I remember we shot the scene, the oyster eating scene at Musso and Frank's. We used to shoot a lot there. It's a great iconic restaurant in Hollywood for those that don't know. And it's got three different sort of rooms. There's the front room, which is sort of booths lined up. And then there's a kind of a counter in the back and there's looks almost like a breakfast area. And then there's a more formal side on the other side of the, in this room, or the more formal side with a sort of etched glass divider. So you could shoot there. You could shoot a whole episode there because it looked like four different locations. So we would shoot a lot there. And we were in a booth that scene, the scene that, you know, the one of the best parts about that is you don't see it coming, is that you forget that this is revenge, that he's doing this on purpose, you know, pumping him full of oysters and martinis to get him to, you know, I'm not sure he intended to embarrass him in front of the Nixon people, but just to out drink him, outdo him, and show him that because it was. Because
you had hit on, Roger had hit on Betty.
Because I had hit on Betty at his house, you know, the week before. Tim Hunter directed it, who was terrific and directed some great early episodes. And just the funny dialogue about like Lucille Ball getting married and divorced twice. And how does that work? Oh yeah, you wake up in the morning and go, oh yeah, I forgot I hate you. Or or how much they like redheads or whatever they were talking about. And then there was the long sequence going up the stairs, which we shot at LA Center in the stairwell. And then the actual vomit part was, you know how usually you see in a movie and it's just basically an actor has like a mouthful of Campbell soup or something. And then kind of,
yeah,
it's always a sort of, it's difficult to actually make it look like there's something else. There's something actually, you know, an eruption. And so there was a hose, you know, and a upstage side, you know, hidden. And then that, I just saw that actually the other day. It's pretty funny. And it was, you know, I forget what it was, but that's how they rigged it. And that's, I just saw the movie Triangle of Sadness. Have you seen that? Where that whole sequence?
I was just going to say Triangle of Sadness.
And yeah. I think there's some rigging going on there because it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, there would have to be.
But yeah, it was a great fun. I mean, you know, John and I had such fun scenes to shoot together and we hit it off right away. Day one, we had a long scene where he was doing most of the talking while taking his shirt off, getting a clean shirt out of the desk, unwrapping it, putting it back on. You know, re-buttoning it, putting his thing back, tying his tie. We were just, you know, and I had the easy part was just sort of pop, you know, piping in every fourth line. But we hit it off right away, and all those scenes were such a good time. We always knew how to work off of each other, and you know that was one of the early ones that was really fun. Mm-hmm.
Going from drunk to high, what do you remember about the world famous LSD episode?
The LSD episode was a couple of things I remember. We like some of the gags, like the cigarette, when I took a puff of the cigarette and it shrinks down, was actually a physical gag where the cigarette had two strings coming out from behind it that would, I guess, on the upstage side, I would hold the cigarette and then somebody would yank on the actual rope and the cigarette would kind of accordion in, you know, as opposed to, which I think was great because you can't really, you can do CGI and stuff like that, but it never really looks as good. And it looks kind of clunky and old school.
By the way, just John, speaking of cigarettes, I know this is a dopey question. Because cigarettes are omnipresent throughout the entire series and very much, you're rarely seen without one. What are you using? Are they cigarettes or are they something else, a stage?
Yeah, those fake cigarettes that they, you know, that, what are they called? Honey Rose, I think. Mm-hmm. Good pull. I think they're called Honey Rose.
You guys had a big budget for that stuff.
Fistfuls. I mean, like, they were disgusting. And they, I mean, they, you know, fine, they serve their purpose. They're not, there's no nicotine in them, I guess.
Right. I was going to say the secondhand smoke problem would have been awful there.
I had quit smoking because I used to smoke. Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Oh, you used to smoke and you quit.
I quit.
Oh, wow.
So this must have been hard.
I had quit. I had gotten hypnotized. It for some reason it didn't make me go back to smoking. I think it created a few smokers. I think some of those guys didn't smoke and then did afterwards for a while.
Yeah, because I mean, I think obviously the addiction is to the nicotine, but there's also something when you get used to just having something in your hand that, like, you feel like you're naked if you don't have something in your hand.
It is a great prop too. I mean, it's just, you know, there was a rule. If you can't smoke, you can't smoke if you don't know how. And, you know, people would come in and there'd be restaurants full of background people or guests, you know, day players or whatever. And it would be clear right away whether somebody was a smoker or not. And it's a great prop unless you don't know how to use one, unless you don't smoke. And then it's very distracting because you spot it a mile away.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about another scene, which you are in, but I believe you also directed this episode as well, Signal 30. The scene I wanted to ask you about in particular is one of my favorites in the whole show, which is when Pete gets into the fight with Lane and you and Don are watching. And I imagine that required some blocking and just some figuring out, you know, just positioning and stuff like that. Was that?
Yeah.
Was that a challenging, particularly challenging scene to direct? Or like you said, did it just kind of direct itself because it was just all the pieces were already there?
Well, yeah. I mean, the shot listing of it was, and trying to figure out how to shoot it was challenging. But I'm trying to think. I remember one thing with that Jared Harris had hurt his neck. I forget. I don't know how he did it, but he had hurt his neck. He had a disc issue. And he was shooting a scene for Lincoln, the mm-hmm. Spielberg movie, and he was supposed to be General Grant, I think, and he was arriving on his horse, and he had to tell Steven Spielberg that he couldn't ride. And Spielberg was like, I'm sorry, because there was this huge set piece, and he said, I've hurt my neck, I can't ride a horse. Mm-hmm. And if he couldn't ride a horse, you know, it was going to be tricky to put him in a boxing match. So we choreographed it in that conference room and then stunt coordinators and all that, making sure that nobody hit each other. But it was touch and go as to whether Jared was going to be able to actually, he was more of a sort of, you know, bare knuckles, you know, his style was very upright. And it wasn't until he threw a couple of punches that he was like, okay, I think I'm all right. And luckily Pete's the one that gets knocked down. So he didn't really have to fall. But yeah, it took some doing. I mean, again, it was just a great story. So I feel lucky to have gotten that script.
But I mean, it all looked very real. Like some fight scenes you can tell where they're sort of cheating a little bit, and that does not look like they're cheating at all. So that's a testament to you, I think.
Well, just how about the writing leading up to that? Doesn't he say something like he calls him, I don't know, Pete says something horrible to him and he says, that's it. He takes his coat off.
Yes.
And he goes, okay, Grandpa. You want to take your teeth out? Or you want me to knock them out? I mean, just the greatest, the funniest, and you know, Vincent Kartheiser is that. I think that might have been my favorite character on the show because
I love Pete Campbell. I hate him and I love him.
and he was always right. I mean, you look back and he was right about everybody, Kennedy, on down. I mean, as far as what direction the place should go, and he just, you know, had issues with his MO, but he's just great and very much, you know, a huge departure from Vincent's actual personality too, mm-hmm. which was a testament to his skill in playing that guy, because that was not who he is.
So there was a point there where Matt and AMC had a pretty long, maybe contentious renegotiation at some point, and things got held up a little bit. So once all the smoke cleared, was it business as usual after that, or things change at all, or sort of nothing to really report there?
I think Matt would have a different story having been on the inside of that. But for us, it was a long period not doing the show. And then I think it changed schedules. It used to be, for myself, my wife, Talia, played Mona.
Right.
And we had a little kid when we started. He was 6 years old. My son Harry, when we started, he was six. And when in the last episode aired, he was 16.
Wow.
So it was, you know, and it was like that for all of us. I mean, it was, you know, a large chunk of our lives was spent, you know, doing the show. Not all the time. It was usually about half the year. But it was in the summer, usually. We would go out to L.A. and we would, you know, kind of find a place to live and do that. And then it flipped. So when after that negotiation, when we started shooting, it was a different, it was like from the fall to the spring. So that meant we've always lived in New York, whereas most of the other cast, I think all of them lived in L.A. So I was on a plane all the time just because Talia wasn't in it as much because Roger had gotten divorced. And so Mona wasn't in the show every episode. And so it basically changed my life in that way. But I don't, being back on the show and after that negotiation, it didn't, to me, change the, you know, the expectation of the show or the quality of it in any way.
When the show ended, did you get the opportunity to take any kind of a souvenir, a costume, a prop or anything like that, that you wanted?
I have a lamp from my office, a modern, beautiful lamp that is in my house. Yeah. But I don't really see it every day. There wasn't any place to put it, but it's in my basement, actually. Yeah, everybody was like, yeah, you'd keep all those suits. And the last thing you wanted to keep was one of those suits. First of all, you've been wearing it for 10 years and it stunk. You know, they didn't stink, but they, you know, I don't think anybody knows that, people don't know that, you know, there are studios keep the clothes after you finish movies and television. And then they, you know, there's a giant stage, costume departments have hundreds and thousands of suits and everything you can imagine from every kind of thing. So when you do a job, you go in and you try on, you end up wearing someone else's suit from 1935 or 1945 or whatever it was in the beginning of this. So it's a collection of old stuff and stuff that they had made. And so by the time you finish using it, it's a little ripe.
Going back and watching, as I have been, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there's the dynamic between the men and the women in the office, very much appropriate for the time, you know, fair amount of sexism, a little bit of misogyny.
A little?
A lot. you know, we now live in a culture that's paying a lot more attention to that. But just, I mean, could you talk about, and also the female characters pushing back in a way which may or may not have been appropriate at the time. Can you talk a little bit about how that was portrayed on the show and what you guys thought of it at the time?
Well, I mean, it was sort of the point of the whole exercise was showing people who were witnesses to history, who were witnesses to that history. They weren't the history makers. They were the, you know, like everyone else, they were witness to some of the momentous moments in the period in which that show took place, from the misogyny to the racism to the anti-Semitism, right from the very beginning. The first scene, one of the first scenes, Don's in a bar and he's asking, trying to figure out Lucky Strike, and he's out of ideas. He's got he's totally blocked, and he asks the waiter in the bar, who's black, about his preference of cigarettes. I think he had his cigarettes in his breast pocket. And he said, no, when we used to, he goes, why do you smoke those? He said, well, when I was in the army, this is what they gave us. So it was, I think it's something like that. I'm probably, you know, fudging that, but, and then he gets, and then a white manager comes over and says, is he bothering you? And he's like, no, just asking the guy a question. They said, you know, it was immediately clear that it wasn't, that this was what the show was about. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a story that took place in a world that peripherally happened. It was settled right in the middle of it, and that was the whole point of it. So,
well, it was done very well from beginning to end.
Incredibly well.
Yeah.
And subtly and off center, and it always, you know, like the show, it always came at subjects from an unexpected angle. I mean, JFK gets assassinated And it was the point of view was from our family, our daughter getting married. So, you know, what do you do in a situation where you've got this momentous occasion in your own family and something like that happens? It's just an interesting angle on so much of it.
Yeah.
Well, what I would say is, you know, you could watch TV shows that were made 5 years ago or 10 years, well, in your case, 10 years ago, but you watch that, you know, you look back at them now and they don't really hold up as well in that regard or feel as right, given where the world has been going, where the culture has been going. And I think, you know, I mean, I think that's part of the timelessness and the brilliance of Mad Men is it all feels right. Even now in 2023.
Well, I also think it's very tricky to do a show that shows the reality as you were just describing, John, but doesn't condone it. And you can feel in the way it's presented that it's not condoning it, but it's also not preachy about it either. I think that's a really tricky balance to get right. And like you said, incorporating the actual events in history, it did that in a very elegant way. You know, I won't name any movies or TV shows, but I've seen many that don't do it in such an elegant way. And I think Mad Men really distinguished itself for that.
Yeah, I think he had the confidence and the ability to tell the story of that period in such a kind of an iconic but offhand way, you know, sort of left of center way. No pun intended there politically. But, you know, just sort of didn't ever bang it on the head. It was always just, you know, coming at an angle, you go, I would not have described that period that way. You know, the death of Marilyn Monroe and how Christina Hendricks' character took it so hard. And right. I don't know, it was always interesting, you know. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned what great chemistry you had with Jon Hamm when you were working on Mad Men, and you've obviously stayed connected and worked together again, most recently in Confess Fletch, which I loved. In fact, I wrote an entire piece for Vulture about how much I love seeing you guys together again, because there's that one two-shot of you in the bar that is like almost identical to a two-shot from Mad Men, and it just really delighted me. Is there any chance that they're going to make another one of those? Because the end of that movie really sets it up for a sequel. But what are the odds of that happening?
Pretty good, I think.
Yeah?
I think it did well. I think the movie did well. I think it did well internationally. I think that was the plan. There are like 11 of those books. Mm-hmm. Three of them now have been done, maybe.
Right.
With Fletch, the Chevy, and then they did a sequel, and then this one. So there's still a lot of that material, and I think that stands a pretty good chance.
Speaking of Jon Hamm, tell us about your most recent project, where feature film you directed with John and Tina Fey, right?
Right. Movie called Maggie Moore's, which just got a distribution deal, domestic deal here.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Which I produced and directed. It's Tina and John and Nick Mohammed.
Oh, nice.
From Ted Lasso, right, among other things. A great performance by a guy named Micah Stock, who's got a sort of central role in it. And it's based on it's a comedy about a double murder. It's based on a true story. Two women with the same name in the same town in the same week were found dead and they never figured it out.
Huh.
And that's what it's about.
And is it going to get a theatrical release or a streaming, or you're not?
It'll be a theatrical release in June.
Oh, June. Okay. I didn't realize the date had already been announced.
Yeah. I don't think there's an actual date yet, but as far as I'm told, June.
Okay.
Is when it'll be released, in theaters. Okay.
So is your focus more on directing projects now, or is it just kind of a split between acting and directing? Like, what are you kind of most invested in at this point?
You know, you do one and you just can't wait to do the other, because the last thing you want to do is direct another movie, at least for me. I don't know. I mean, it's always that way, too. You finish a TV show and you're like, I just want to go do a play or something that isn't this. So, I like directing very much. It takes a while to get things set up. It takes a long time to, you know, the whole thing takes a couple of years between the start, and then throw COVID in there. So it's stop, start a couple of times. So it's, and then, you know, it's a weird time for movies. It's tricky raising money. It's tricky selling movies. And then it's kind of a crapshoot as to where they end up.
Gets a little easier when you get John and Tina, right, to agree to do this.
It definitely helps, yeah. But I mean, just as far as people with the way they view movies, you know, I used to go to the movies all the time, and people don't go as much, and I remember telling someone I saw their movie that they directed, and they said, where? And I said, on the flight back from L.A. And they kind of hung their head like, aww, don't ever tell anybody you saw their movie on an airplane. And I was on a plane the other day, and I was like, I'd be thrilled if I walked down the aisle and people were watching this movie on an airplane. Because that's where people watch movies a lot these days. Or, you know, I guess, or at home on television. This will have the theatrical release, which I'm thrilled about, because there's no substitute for a couple hundred people in a room in the dark watching it. You know, it's just different. The experience is different, and it's better as far as telling a story and you know, the experience, I think.
I mean, it's a hard time for everybody, TV as well. Like, even they've shot entire seasons of shows and been like, eh, never mind, we're not going to show you that. It's scary.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Mad Men, I think, plays a role in all that. You know, there was the era of Mad Men, and the era that introduced, I think, with, you know, the kind of programming that people on TV were doing beyond HBO, really began to fill, you know, that's what you used to go to the movies for, right? On a Friday night, they would make the kind of movie that you just made, John, you know, which is a, you know, great high concept, great cast, you know, people you wanted to see, great story. And they kind of stopped doing that in the movie business. And then the quality of the television shows, you know, just, they were making more, they were making great, great, great shows. And then of course streaming came along, and, you know, certainly people like me thought, well, maybe I'll just stay home Friday night. There's something good on TV to watch versus having to go to the movies for that kind of quality.
Yeah. Complicated stories, not necessarily, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's, I don't know, the economics of it or make it weird. I mean, the movie going experience, I mean, the whole process, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to get people to go back to the theaters. I guess there's an uptick of late, but
right.
And I hope it comes back. Yeah, the television, the material in television has been phenomenal, and that's where those stories are.
Yeah.
But I wonder, especially in the current climate, I feel like if Mad Men had started like a year ago, maybe, like, it might not have gone all the way to 7 seasons, like, because they're just canceling so many things. And Mad Men is the kind of show that is a slow burn, and it takes its time. And I just could see them. I mean, I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I don't. I think Mad Men, just on critical acclaim, buzz, you know, I'm sure it did very good ratings for AMC.
Yeah.
Maybe not Walking Dead, but it did incredibly great, you know. And I think Mad Men, just on quality, lives.
I think there are a lot of shows out there that, you know, it's a niche business, you know. It's a, where you the requirements, I mean, look at, you know, they're all single digits. I mean, if you got 8 million people watching a show in 1990, whatever, you wouldn't have made the second episode.
Right.
So I think I agree with Doug that it was good. It was so good and so specific that it would have survived. But it's hard to cut through the noise. I mean, that's the thing, is like, how do you get people's attention? Right.
A lot of choices.
When you can literally fill up your car with gas and there's a TV show playing on the gas pump. You're like, this stuff is everywhere.
Yeah. And by the way, that was, my comment was not at all about the quality of the show. I've just become extremely cynical in the past couple months, as I've seen so many shows getting canceled that I think are very, very good. So that's where that's coming from. I'm mad at the cable execs like Doug.
No, streaming execs, not cable execs. Streaming execs.
Yes. Okay. Absolve yourself of all responsibility. Yeah, exactly. Sure.
What's your favorite show that got canceled?
You know, there's a great show that was on Showtime called Work in Progress that I really loved that got canceled. Jason Kadams made a show last year that focused on these autistic young adults that was really lovely and beautiful, and it got canceled. So, I mean, there, I could make a list probably all day.
Yeah.
She watches a lot of TV, John.
I do. I'm a TV critic. It's my
job. It's her job. You want to, got anything else you want to cover, Jim, for the last one?
No, I don't want to keep John too much longer. So I think we should ask him our usual last question, which is, aside from things that you've worked on yourself, what is your favorite basic cable television show of all time?
Oh my God. Basic cable television show of all time. Oh, I just remembered what that AMC show was. It was called Remember When.
Oh, that's right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Glad we cleared that up.
Ironic that we couldn't remember it.
I don't think I have an answer for this. I don't. How could I not have an answer for this? And I know I should have thought about this, and I tried, But like,
do you go Breaking Bad? Do you go?
Well, I didn't want to say Breaking Bad because, you know, we used to have this like sort of rivalry with Breaking Bad where we would go to the Emmys and we would get a bunch of acting nominations and they would, you know, we would all get nominated for all kinds of stuff. And then we would lose all the acting awards we would lose. And I would be the first one that lost every night.
Right. Right. Best supporting actors early in the show.
Every
that, right?
Award show. I was the first one that lost. I'd be sitting there and Ham would be sitting in front of me and he would go, get away from me. Go. He'd go, you loser. Get away. Get the heck. Go sit over there. Because, and then we won the best show there for a few years in a row and they would win all the acting awards. So they were sort of, and I don't know, for whatever reason, I watched Pilot and then I stopped and then I went back during COVID and I watched it and I,
oh really? Yeah.
It's pretty hard to dispute how great it is.
Well, mm-hmm. we'll take that. We'll take that as your answer.
And those guys are so great. So that maybe a little Saul thrown in there. That sort of,
oh yeah, sure.
Great.
Yeah.
That's a great show also.
Well, yeah. John, we really appreciate having you today. We appreciate you spending some time with us. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So that was a great discussion with John Slattery. And we had a little point of debate toward the end there when I said that I wasn't sure Mad Men would be made for a full 7 seasons if it got greenlit, you know, in the past couple years, only because I just think that streamers and cable networks are just, they just don't have a lot of patience to wait and see what kind of cultural impact something is going to make. And it's not a knock on Mad Men. I think it's great, but I'm glad it came along when it did because I'm not sure it would have been able to have the life it did if it had come along a little bit later.
Well, I'm gonna disagree a little bit like I did on in our previous conversation. In that I think if it got on the air, it probably had a decent chance of continuing, at least the way I remember the way, you know, it sort of, you know, built. But I think maybe the bigger question is it, would anybody greenlight a show in 2023 about a bunch of white guys, you know, going back to a day when, you know, sort of white men, you know, sort of ruled the roost in a very particular way. Would that, you know, forget about how elegantly the show was done and how brilliantly mm-hmm. it was written and everything about it. But, you know, would that pass the smell test, you know, for a development executive or a streaming exec in 2023?
I mean, it's an interesting question. Again, I think the thing about Mad Men to me was that it was presenting these guys, but not condoning their behavior. And over time, and even in some of the earlier seasons, like the women were the real heroes.
Yes.
Joan and Peggy and even to some extent, Betty for putting up with Don's bullshit. Like,
right.
And I think that I always sensed that watching the show. I never sensed that they thought these guys are great. Aren't they hilarious? Although there are certainly people who could watch it and come away with that attitude. But I do think because it is so subtle, that might be an issue as well. But I also think it's the kind of show that just, like I said, it takes its time. It's really detail-oriented. And the reason I think that we love these characters so much, or at least, you know, I miss them a great deal, is because it had the ability to do that, to just let you, like, hang out with these people and observe them in a way that a show that's, like, super plot-driven and has to be, you know, X number of episodes, like, can't do that.
And by the way, in a way that I'm trying to think of another show I could even compare to it in the regard that you just, you know, sort of pointed out. It really feels singular in that regard.
Well, I mean, there are shows that take their time and that are very focused on human behavior as opposed to plot.
But no, but I mean, you're going back to what you said about, you know, the time, the place and the uh-huh. characters that inhabited it. And, you know, it almost feels like a snapshot of a particular time and place and the people who are living in it. You know, sort of anything else. I'm not sure I've ever felt that way about another show.
Well, and as we've talked about, I think, like, nostalgia drives so much of what, you know, ends up being on our screens. And often now it's nostalgia for Star Wars or nostalgia for some kind of a franchise. But Mad Men kind of approached that from a different way because it was, I mean, it was hugely influential in terms of fashion and home design. I mean, there were millions of articles written about, you know, what impact it had there. So in that sense, it was nostalgia. It just wasn't like nostalgia for how people were treated.
Right.
And that gets back to where it's, like you said, kind of tricky to balance those two things.
It was so well done. I mean, in terms of its, you know, the way its accuracy in depicting the style and the culture and the wardrobes of the time and even the way people spoke and acted. Like now watching it several years later again, it feels like it, you know, could have been made in the period that it depicts. It's that well done.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And I hate period things that are like, sometimes you watch something that's set in a period and it feels like it's set at like an 80s party as opposed to in the actual 80s.
Right, right, exactly.
And this never felt that way.
Ever.
There's a Christmas party scene in one of the episodes where there's a woman wearing like a green dress that's like brocade flowers. My mother had that. She had that dress. I wore it to my homecoming dance in ninth grade. and it was her dress from like the 60s. So it was very accurate.
All right, final point before we go. So in watching it now, Don Draper at the time, I think, struck me as complicated, dark, et cetera. And watching it now, he seems like a sociopath. And am I alone on this?
No, I think that's fair. And I would say that part of the reason that you didn't completely – you know, dislike him or not want to watch him was because of John Hamm. Like, he has a really great way of like leaning into those dark parts of who Don is, but also just being sort of droll and like a little bit like, I kind of want to be that guy, just minus all the lies and the sleeping around and all the bad things that he does.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we hope you enjoyed our conversation with John Slattery as much as Jen and I did. And hope you'll be back with us next time on Basic.
Basic is a Pantheon Media production in partnership with SiriusXM.
Hosted by Jen Chaney
and Doug Herzog.
Produced by Christian Swain and Peter Ferrioli.
Lindley Ehrlich is our assistant producer.
Sound design and music by Jerry Danielson.
Mixed and mastered by Brian Slusher.
Recorded and edited by Zach Spisner.
You can find Basic on Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, and share so other people can find us.
Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.